I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Liverpool Lad by Peter Haas is one of the more charming books you'll ever read. It's such an engaging, entertaining, funny, melancholy memoir that you can feel awfully nostalgic about the era and place in which Peter grew up without even having to set foot in Liverpool. A remarkable storyteller, Peter Haas takes us to the working-class slums he grew up in the 1950s and 1960s, the youngest of four boys. You get a real sense of the times, the struggles, as well as the kinship and camaraderie that defines Peter and his family. The book takes us to the cusp of Peter's adulthood as he and the family move to Australia, but what an eventful, memorable bunch of years that are covered in this book. Peter Haas joins me now. I'll ask him about this book and more. He is an electrician, builder, musician, artist, gardener, letterpress printer, and a former preacher and scriptural teacher and political activist. He eventually immigrated to Canada in 1971 before settling on Salt Spring Island in 1990 with his wife, the writer and publisher Mona Furtick. The book is published by Mother Tongue. Please welcome to the Plant Online program in person today, Peter Haas. Mr. Haas, good morning.
Hi, Joseph.
Thanks for coming in to do this. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
You know, I'd read this book, I guess. I bought it off the site when it came out, just after it came out. Mm-hmm. And so I've been reading it since then. And I stopped.
So you must be a slow reader, eh, Joseph?
Well, you know, here's the thing. I didn't want it to end. I really didn't want it to end. Because I knew that it would take us to 17, 18 years old in your life. Yeah. And so many of the people that you talk about in this book are just so rich in character, loving. Some of them are scoundrels, but all of them, endearing. And so when you sit down to write a book like this, I guess it's the people that you remember the most, isn't it?
No, the funny thing has happened about 2 or 3 years ago, is that I was told about a website regarding my old district where I was brought up.
In Liverpool.
In the downtown centre of Liverpool, the district of Everton, which is a very old, you know, working class district. It was put together, like, say, the early 1800s, with the purpose of housing all the workers that were going to be building ships, working at the docks, etc., etc. Now, Liverpool has the longest docks in the world. I think they probably still have 10 miles of continuous docks, and all that. So you got these warrens of row by row houses, thousands and thousands of houses, tens of thousands of people. And this particular site that was set up a few years back, it was called the Lost Tribe of Everton. I went on this site, and there was a blog.
Yeah.
So I go to the blog, and, you know, like, everyone's talking about the same street I knew and the same school I went to and all that, back in the 50s, right? So I thought, I'll put a little blurb in here, right? So I stuck this little memory in there. I went to such a street between 1955 and 61, bloody blah. My name was, at the time, Peter Haas.
Yeah.
I grew up with that name till I was 16.
Right?
Uh-huh. So 2 hours later, this fella jumps on from Manila, who sat two desks away from me.
In school.
In school.
Yeah.
And he says, Peter, he says, this is Alan Bruce here. We always called you the memory man. I says, what? He says, the memory man. Because, you know, like, every Monday morning, the teacher put me up in front of the classroom to recite the scriptures, you know, the Psalms and all that stuff, you know. Because it was rammed into my little head from the time I could think, you know, like sit up and think, you know. So he says, the memory man. Now, a lot of people still remark, as you just remarked, about my reference to a certain age, a certain time. How I could have that memory in such a clear manner. Because these people did stand out in my mind.
Yeah.
And every bit I've written in that book is actually what happened, according to my young mind and young vision, you know, the street fight when an old geezer took on the coal man, you know, that kind of stuff. Well, what was I, about 5 or 6 years old, you know, etc., etc. So I do have a bit of an uncanny memory, and for detail.
Yeah, and see, this is the thing. I've never been to England. I've never crossed the Atlantic. I mean, I've seen Liverpool in movies, perhaps.
The old movies, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like I was there with you.
Dirty, grungy old Liverpool.
Does it really smell as bad as you describe?
Well, it depends on the day, you know. It could be a garbage collection day, you know, blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
But, it was a grungy old town where I grew up. The outskirts, of course, you know, is way different. But imagine there's 125,000 people that were uprooted from Everton when they flattened the place. And they just demolished the place because it was all bombed houses and run-down houses, and the streets are all leaning over and everything, you know. We've got big steel rods going all through all the houses with huge bars on the end to hold the buildings together, you know, that kind of stuff. So they uprooted 125,000 people, I think between like 57, 58 and 61, and we were sent out to the ghettos out yonder, you know.
What was the name of the place again?
Childwall.
Yeah.
Childwall Valley.
Yeah. So where were your parents born?
Both of them born in Liverpool.
Yeah. Yeah. And so the four boys, you're the youngest of the four, born also there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. The lessons that come out of this book for me, family, a sense of place, hard work. And in your case, hard work at a very early age. You wanted to make money.
Well, we weren't given any money. There was no money to be had, you know. Like, the two folks had these jobs. They were very loving parents.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was extremely religious. So I never once saw him swear in his life. But before all this happened, like, way back when he was about 30 years old, he got converted, you know.
Yeah.
And the old fellow was born in 1896. And people look at me and say, what? And I said, well, yeah, he was 54 years old when I was born, you know.
Yeah.
And I was the youngest of four within 5 years. So my mother was like baby, 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 you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And all in the same bed.
Yeah.
So
And he showered together. And,
you know, he grew up actually in the reign of Victoria.
Mm.
So in that era, you know, the Victorian head stayed with him from his parents. And he raised us in such a same kind of a manner, you know. So we were raised by an old guy with old ways. He was a First World War vet, you know, in the war from the age of 18 to 22, etc. You know, a professional soccer player. He was a sailor, you know, a rounder. You call him a rounder at the time, right? You know, round, get around, I get around.
Kind of thing.
And, you know, he was into everything, the drinking, the gambling, the smoking, the women. And then when he got converted at the age of 30, like, you know, his whole life changed around. And he became a very astute student of Scripture. And a lay preacher. So all the time I knew him, he was like, it was Bible.
Yeah.
Crack over the head, God loves you, you know. Yeah. Behave yourself, God loves you.
Yeah. What did your mother do? What was her job?
My mother had menial work, you know. She worked at a biscuit factory, and she was a cleaner. She worked after hours at the school, cleaning up the school, etc. She was a very, very smart woman, but didn't have the opportunity of going further with her education, but she excelled in her intelligence.
Yeah, you could tell that she had a very good mind.
Very good mind.
In the way that she treated you boys and him, your father.
Yeah, she had to compromise a little bit. She was 24 years younger than him.
Yeah.
So she married this guy in the Second World War, handsome fella, you know. And they had the four children. And she just put up with, tolerated his ways, his religious ways, which she also accompanied his religious ways. But she was also softer hearted. He was a bit of a hard lad, you know.
Yeah.
Told me that later in life, you know, that the two wars had ruined him for life.
Yeah.
You know, over a little drink. I never had a drink with him in my life. But when we immigrated to Australia, and I went for a quick visit, we were at the airport as I'm flying back. I said, Dad, we've never had a drink in our lives. Here you are, about 85 years old. Do you want to have a quick tot before I jump on that plane? Well, why not, you know?
Yeah.
So I says, God, this is a surprise, you know. I'm having a beer and a double chaser at Scotch Place, so what are you having, Dad? Double rum, straight up. I said, my goodness.
Yeah.
Double rum for the old fella here, you know. So he started to cry in his drink.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. He says, this takes me back to the trenches. In the trenches, he said, the rum flowed like a river. And he says, half the guys were fighting, climbing over the wall there to take on the Hun, and they were all drunk.
Mm.
They had to be drunk to do it. Mm. So he said, this takes him back, you know. And then he said to me, I've been a hard ass dad, you know, blah, blah, blah. The two wars ruined me for life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the relationship before that, because there was a bit of, I guess, a bit of mistrust between the two of you. I mean, you write that in the book, that there was a point where you wondered what motivated him, and you know, you'd have these jobs, of course, you'd earn your own money, and then you'd have to give him, and then you started not telling him everything that you made.
That started at a very early age, of course, you know. I mean, like, you could never reach your hand out to our fella, old fella, and say, Dad, I've got a couple of coppers, you know. A couple of coppers is a couple of pennies, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because we had our own language at that time, right? You're looking at, you know, who are you looking at? Tuppence for you, what are you talking about, right? So, another time too, I came home from school, all my pennies had disappeared. I had a little cachet on the side, you know, that I'd polish up with Brasso to make them look like brand new pennies, you know, and they were my pride and joy. They're gone. I said to my brothers, who knocked off me money, like, you know, I'm only a tiny boy. My dad walks by and says, oh, you mean those pennies that were in the cupboard there? He says, they're mine. I says, Dad, he says, understand this, lad, and I'm a very tiny boy, all money that comes in this house is my money. Is that understood? Now, it sort of registered at an early age, you know, and I thought, well, I'm not going to get any pocket money off him, you know. And every other kid in the street I knew was knocking off.
Yeah.
You know, they'd be taking sweets or ciggies or whatever the case, right, you know, finding stuff for free, you know. And I thought, well, better join the gang. You know, I mean, they're all having a great old time. And they're in the same boat as me. Very few people I knew got pocket money. Very few had nobody had a telephone.
Yeah.
Nobody had a car. You know, so it was all like, we're all in the same boat.
Yeah.
Just a working class poverty.
And when was it that you started at the butcher?
Butcher boy was 14 years old.
Yeah, and so to this day you can still, if we give you a side of beef, you can cut it up and really do it.
2 years in 5 different butcher shops.
Yeah.
I was only in one butcher shop, mind you, for just a day and a half.
Yeah.
Till he put a knife to my throat and said, keep away from the till. He was a crazy guy anyway, right?
Yeah.
But the other ones really trained you well in the art of butchery.
Yeah, you see that in movies or TV shows sometimes, just how the English do that a little more elegantly than most other places.
Well, some people have some people like you say elegant. They have an elegant way of wielding the knife.
Yeah. So it is a poverty reality that you all encounter, subsistence living. But you all didn't seem to go hungry, and that's the other thing that I got in this book, and you described so beautifully and so evocatively, the sort of meals that you'd have, even just a bacon and egg sandwich. With all the grease and the sort.
Well, that was pretty well once a week.
Yeah.
Other than that, going to school was like cornflakes on the way out, you know, stuff like that. Very rarely we'd be getting stuck into bacon and eggs, etc. That was definitely on a Sunday morning, though. And Sunday afternoon, of course, was the big roast.
The roast.
But you lived on a lot of menial things, you know. It was fish and chips once a week, of course. And we did it on Wednesdays to show the rest of the street we weren't Catholics, you know. We made sure we had a piece of meat on Friday.
And then you talk about going to Torquay and all the smoked mackerel.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Yeah. I mean, I've never had that, and I don't really care for it, but...
You like smoked fish?
I like smoked salmon. That's the only thing.
Yeah.
Is it close to that?
I should have brought you one. I got smoked salmon at home.
Is it close to mackerel?
No. Smoked mackerel is like almost like a kipper.
Yeah.
You know? So you fry it up for breakfast kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
But they are tasty and strong tasting, you know,
yeah.
But delicious.
Yeah. Do you still fish a lot on Salt Spring?
Yes, I love the fish.
Yeah,
I have a small boat, you know, but you're lucky to get a salmon these days. You have to wait till the run goes by, you know.
Yeah.
But I never get skunked. I always get a bottom fish, you know.
Yeah.
And drop the crab trap.
Yeah. So the youngest of four boys, your three other brothers, the experiences that you had, were they similar to what they had? I mean, except you had them later than they did, say?
I don't think they were at all the same. I've related many of my stories and adventures to them, and a lot of them have nothing at all like it.
Yeah.
Jeff, my closest brother, he was a real adventurer. He was a sailor. He took off at the age of like 16, went to the sea training school. I was to follow him later, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's only 2.5 years older than me. So that all fell through when he jumped ship in New Zealand, had to be brought back home, right? In disgrace. dishonorably discharged, they call it. So I was all lined up to go to sea with him. And so he travelled the world, a bit of a lad, a hell of a lad, actually. A scrapper, a bit of a knockoff, generous heart. You know, we all had generous hearts. We all gave to each other.
Yeah.
And gave to our friends. So, you know, I think... I think that growing up with Nout, you know, sort of does that. But, you know, I mentioned earlier about hunger. We were hungry a lot at an early age. Because I think till the late 50s or mid-late 50s, you know, say 57, Britain was still rationed. So it was many of the time we all go to bed starving hungry. Like, man, we're starving hungry, like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And she say, make a sugar butty, see. So we'd, you know, do your white bread, margarine, and white sugar on top, and that would fill you up for the morning, right?
Yeah. And then later on, you get milk at school.
We always got milk at school. One third of a pint.
Right.
Every kid in England got that.
Yeah. So food does play an important part in memory, doesn't it? Not just in your book, but I mean, if you remember, I mean, you'll remember what you had more than at a dinner party, say, than the conversation sometimes. Do you notice that?
Well, you know, of all the subjects in the world, I think food is one of the most universal. Where everyone can sit down and relate the story about food.
Yeah.
The shittiest food they ever ate, right? The best meal they ever cooked,
yeah.
Right? You know, and things that are well known from where they come from, right? Like, I'm on Salt Spring lamb,
yeah.
Right? I love a nice leg of lamb and all that, right?
Yeah.
So food, of course, is a tasty part of the story.
Yeah. When you think back to your childhood, these formative years, other than food, I guess, music also played a big part, don't you
music
think?
Was incredibly big, yeah. Incredibly big. From a very early age, I sang, I danced, I performed, jumped around, acted up, you know. It was me and my friend Gray, who he went to Australia before me, a few years before me. And he would have a good laugh at his house after school. His mother would put the radio on. She was a real dancer, you know. She'd dance around cleaning up the house or making fish and chips or whatever the case, right? And she asked me to get on the table and perform, you know.
Yeah.
So it was always in me to get up there and dance and sing and all that, you know. But my father withheld all that. We had an old gramophone that you wind up.
Uh-huh.
But the half a dozen records we had, like the old 78s, were like, we'd all religious songs, you know. And we knew them backwards, you know, and we got sick and tired of them. When he was out, there might be a kid down the street who had a record, like from Buddy Holly or someone, Elvis, you know.
Uh-huh.
We'd sneak it in the house and put it on, you know,
yeah.
Etc. I'd have to keep winding it because the old thing kept on making Elvis sound a little slow, you know, you have to wind the thing up a little bit. You know.
Older Elvis, right? You
know, treat me like a fool.
God. And so the abilities that you have, the gifts that you have as a storyteller, as an artist, as a performer, I guess those were honed at an early age, weren't they?
Yeah, you know, there was always music in the house, but it was classical.
Yeah.
So my mother would put the BBC on while she was home from work, and we're all helping around the kitchen prepare, right? So one's peeling spuds, one's doing this, and the old and we all knew the tunes.
Yeah.
We'd all whistle along and with the tunes, because it was like week after day after day, and it was like wordless stuff, except for like Saturdays when we put on Children's Favourites, and the Children's Favourites was a well-known BBC show. You know, that we all sang along with. But it was always in me to do it. My father said, none of that. And then when I walked home that time with the guitar from the Salvation Army Boys Club, right,
mm-hmm.
where they were trying to teach guitar, he says, get that thing out of here. You know, that's the devil's music, right? He said, devil's music, Dad. We've got to learn the choruses from church, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He said, get it out of here, like, you know. And she came around, the Sergeant Major, right?
Yeah.
A beautiful Sergeant Major, too. She's mid-25 or so, you know.
Yeah.
Gorgeous. With a little uniform on, Salvation Army. Please, he says, forget it, get that thing.
Yeah.
So I secretly made my own little guitar, right? Like a little square box,
right?
You know, with fishing lines on it. And, you know, wind up the screws on the end to get a ding, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And I get in front of the mirror, she loves you, yeah, whatever, you know,
uh-huh.
etc. Until I got to the point where my brother brought home an old used Czechoslovakian guitar he won on a card game. At sea,
mm-hmm.
walked in the house with it and says, yeah, Pete, finally you got one, right? And everyone looked at me, my dad looked at me, I says, great, it's mine, you know, and no one's taking it away from me, right, you know.
Yeah. The relationships that you have with the neighbors, the people around you, And you're quite candid in the book about the girls and the ladies that you meet from time to time. Some of them were older than you were.
You can always learn more from an older girl.
I guess, you know, that's what I learned from this book, for sure. What, when you think back to the camaraderie, the friendships that, that you all develop, I mean, do a lot of those stay?
Never.
No?
I wouldn't know a soul. No. I left downtown Everton. I moved to Chilwell. I hardly knew one lad that I grew up with, because nobody travelled my way. I never travelled their way. They went off to the other schools, right?
Yeah.
The higher level schools. I went to my little area. It was like I was sentenced to 5 years of loneliness, in a way, because I couldn't really break through in this new district. And I felt I was surrounded with a lot of backstabbing lads, you know what I mean? I'd experienced that before, but
yeah.
You always have your friends to lean on too. And I was glad when my last 5 years of school was through, you know,
mm-hmm.
especially with the torturous teachers.
Yeah.
They were damaged goods, man, from the war.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of them enjoyed the corporal punishment part.
Yeah.
What was that one incident where, I guess you and your buddy had taken the sandwich off the desk.
Yeah.
And the interesting part of that just struck out for me. The teacher was from elsewhere, right?
Yeah. We had a visiting student teacher from Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
A wonderful fellow. Mr. Wu, you know. And a lovely guy. And he intrigued us with his stories about the jungles and the rubber trees and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, the machete working his way through a jungle, you know. We're all like this. Wow. And but then this particular time came round, he left half a sandwich on the desk, you see. So after school lunch, me and George got back to the classroom, and no one's around. Like, there's half a nice-looking sandwich on the desk there, right? So we just split it in half, you know, half each, gulp, gone. And then the teacher comes back, and right in the middle of stuff, and Mr. Wu leans over and says, you know. So our teacher, like, you know, turns around and says, class, pay attention. We have a thief in our midst, you know. Someone's taking this half a sandwich from the desk. Well, we thought it was just a discarded old sandwich, you know.
Right.
So we wouldn't own up to anything, you know, and then someone squealed on us, right? One of the lads jumped up and squealed, mentioned my name, you know. But we had to stick our hands out and get the cane, one on each hand, right, you know. Now, that was the first time I got the corporal punishment, 8 years old. And it really hurt, you know, a rattan cane.
Yeah.
You know, very heavy and hard, and it went on from there where, you know, throughout school, your experience in that particular age, that time of the 50s and 60s, corporal punishment was prevalent. And some of the teachers loved to dish it out.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, there was one incident that you and a friend were responsible for, and everybody got it.
Well, that was a little while later, you see.
Yeah.
The same teacher.
The same one, you want to get even with him.
Yeah, we stuck the end of his cane in the pencil sharpener. Put a bit of a point on it as a laugh, you know.
Yeah.
Stuck it back on the wall. Well, it was his masculine extension, you know. So he looks at it and goes crazy, you know what I mean? And then the next thing you know, nobody admit to anything, because George and I, by this time, we knew not to open our gobs, you know.
Yeah.
Keep your gob closed, mate, you know.
Yeah.
Loose lips sink ships.
Right.
And then everyone on the class was subjected to one hit each, you see. And I felt very bad about that. I really felt bad about it, because all these lads, they all getting one on the stick when it was me and George did this.
Yeah.
So it's almost our betrayal of the class now, you know.
Yeah. What, the formative years that you cover in this book, what do you regret, if anything? I mean, there's a lot of here that you wouldn't go back and change, obviously. And I suspect there isn't anything that you would change. But I mean, if you would have to think about regrets. I mean, it's a late day day for regrets. But I mean, you know, when you look back at it all, if you had to change something, would there be something you'd change?
There's not much of change. One big thing I would change was some of the company that I kept. And I was told that later on. Of course, I was 16 years old, got in trouble. You know, and the probation officer, he told me, like, you know, like everyone else tells you, you know, keep away from the bad company, you know, that kind of stuff, you know. What you're hanging around with, that influence, you know. But the environment that, you know, we were all in, sort of like, it was very difficult to do that. It was very difficult to keep away from that crowd. And then, you know, you're intimidated. And And also, a lot of it was fun, too, because you're making a bit of money. You're scoring some nice clothes. You know, you're taking the girls out to the movies, right? And you're buying all the fags you want, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, like, there was money, easy money, but, you know, always looking over your shoulder. And I think that, although they're very formative times, you know, later on when I left all that, that's when the goodness arrived.
Yeah.
You know, but I had to escape the environment to do that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, whatever happens in one's early years, you have to go through all the bad stuff to understand it. And then that's how one emerges from all of that.
You know, a lot of the bad stuff, too, did also cause me to be good to others. I think, you know, if you get hit a few times, you become empathizing to those who are about to be hit. So you stand up for those being bullied, things like that.
Yeah.
So I think within that, not unsheltered childhood, you know, like we were never sheltered.
Yeah.
You know, you're out in the morning, you go to school, sometimes you come back a little late, and you're out and about, not like today's kids that are like policed so much, you know. Yeah. Everyone wants to know every minute of the day where they are, right? Well, today too, understandably. It's a bit different world. But we were in a community where like every second house was Uncle Bill and Auntie Annie and all the rest of the stuff. And if you were home early from school and your mum wasn't around, you know, they'd often call you in for a cup of tea while you're waiting for your mum to get home, you know.
Yeah.
So it was like a poverty-stricken environment, society, but with also a big loving heart to have, especially the kids.
Yeah.
The kids were always taken care of.
Yeah, like the kid that had epilepsy that you'd always help.
And, yeah, I was Jimmy next door. I'd help him on the way to school.
Yeah.
I always walked to school with him in case he had a fit, eh?
Yeah.
Because I learned from somebody how to take care of him if he was on the ground there going through his fit. And I'd bring him home sometimes, you know, his mother liked that. So, you know, I think even giving things away, like when I was in the market, you know, see a little old lady go by, right? And they say, come over here, love, do you like those sausages? They're lovely, aren't they? I said, well, you know, I'll buy a pound. She said, I can't afford them. I says, I'll buy a pound.
Yeah.
And they give her a free pound of sausages or whatever, a couple of lamb chops, you know what I mean? Yeah. I said, shh. On your way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was a lot of giving in that crowd.
And there was a moment, too, at the butcher shop. I think it was somebody else. I don't think it was you, though. But it was smart. You gave them a free duck because then they bought the duck.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that's the only place that they would get duck from.
We doctored a whole pile of ugly-looking ducks, ducklings.
Yeah.
And we doctored them so well that we rewrapped them, made them look like Class A, you know what I mean? You know, it would over here be like number one Canada
grade A,
you know?
Yeah.
So they came back. Well, we sold all these ducks off, you know. They were limp, broken-legged and everything, you know. And they enjoyed it so much they came back the following week. They said, what a duck, you know. So Kenny, the boss, said, here, have another one on the house. And they became loyal customers.
Yeah. The era is also unique because this is after the war and it's before the 70s where everything changes.
Yeah. Everything changes.
Yeah. And
the coinage changed.
Yeah.
All the currency changed. Like in 71, I think it was.
Yeah. So when you look back at it all, this was obviously for you the only time that you grew up in, but it was the right time, wasn't it?
Wonderful time. Wonderful time. Our playgrounds were bombed houses, eh? We used to meet after school, a whole pile of us, you know. And I started smoking at the age of 8, you know. And we'd follow people, like, you know, down the street. If he was smoking a fag, like, you know, he'd flick his fag. We'd all jump on it. Hey, you know, pass it around, right, you know. Or go into the cafes and find all the ashtrays and roll all the tobacco in the newspaper and pass it around, you know. Because we had zero, you know. And there are things I actually didn't even write in that book. Because it was getting on. And too many things to write about, you know. Where I went into a shop and I was told by all the gang, when we distract the shopkeeper, you get that carton of cigarettes and run out the door, you see. Well, I ran out the door right into the arms of a policeman. you know, because I was about, 8 years old, tiny, you know.
Yeah. In reflecting on this era, you have two children, you and Mona. What do they make about the way you were raised? And did your experiences, did that influence how you raised those two kids?
It certainly has, because my both children are incredible adults. They're wonderful human beings. They're very, very kind. They're very courageous. I taught my lad from a very early age, be courageous, be chivalrous, but be kind. And always stand up to people who are being bullied. Always stand up against the bully, right? And help those who need help, right? And share. If you have things to share and others don't have it, you better share, mate. So they grew up in a wonderful attitude to life. She's a paramedic, a top-level paramedic. And he was trained as a firefighter and everything. He got all the tickets and everything, you know. So these two have gone on, you know, in their adulthood. And we all love each other greatly. You know, so I get along wonderfully with my kids.
Yeah.
You know, we all adore each other. And they know the poverty I came from, you see. So they laugh at a lot of it, you know. And they read the book and they laugh over all these things. But a lot of it is sort of like foreign, you know, very distant.
Yeah.
It's a different world.
Right.
I was wondering, were these stories that they'd heard growing up or did they learn anything new from the book?
They heard a few new things, I think, yes.
Yeah.
And you know, another thing too, Joseph, is that going into that book is like stepping into the confession box, right? You know, you go in there, you know, and the priest is the world. And you start telling everybody, you know, I did this, did that, but I'm sorry for it, you know what I mean? Like, you know, so doing a memoir can be a little difficult. And I did have a few moments of like sitting looking at the wall thinking, shall I?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, then I thought, bloody hell, just go ahead with it, man. Just write it, you know. It took me 8 years to put that together.
Yeah, so was it your idea to do it?
Yeah, I was always writing.
Yeah.
All my life I've been a writer.
Yeah.
In a small respect. Essays, short stories, occasional poems, songs.
Yeah.
Writing songs and all that, right? But this was something I thought I'd take on. And because they kept on saying, Dad, you told us that story before, tell us a new one. Well, I tell them another thing, see?
Yeah.
They say, what happened when you were 14, Dad? I said, okay, 14, here we go. So it was a chronological book. Starts from zero, goes to 17 when I take off to Australia, right? And all that. So it's chronologically pretty well together. But there's a smattering of things, and it's amazing how things arise as you start talking about other things.
Yeah.
So new stories came up, say, oh, yeah, I remember that happened, but shall I talk about it? Okay. Yeah. You know.
Do you wish your dad had a memoir like this and you could hear his stories?
He has a small memoir.
Oh, he does?
Yes, that my niece wrote in New Zealand.
Mm.
And it's called, you know, it's a little drawing of him that she did. You know, it's a little tiny pamphlet, you know.
Yeah.
And it's called My Story, you know, My Story. He's in, you know, he does all these adventurous things in his early life. He was a real adventurer, my old fella.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the hair-raising things he came out with. Battle of the Somme, you know, he's in all the First World War battles, right? Lost his brother down about 100 yards away from him, blown to pieces, you know.
Mm.
We found Uncle Ted. We found his grave about 5 years ago in France. But he'd gone on there in 1917.
Yeah.
And we found his grave. Yeah. But, also with my family, with the kids, they know that Dad doesn't hide anything. And my dad hid everything.
Yeah.
I didn't find out my real name till I was 16. Didn't find out that the auntie down the road wasn't my auntie. She was my half-sister, Edna, from a previous marriage. Didn't find it. You know, all these things are saying, Dad, why? I mean, you know, you feel so insecure yourself that you can't talk to us about the truth, you know. So that's what the truth does. It either opens you up or it sends you into a closet, you know.
Yeah.
I guess it's also generational because it's about two generations from where you are to where your father was, right? So I think, as you said earlier, it's a very Victorian mindset that he had. Victoria, I guess, she had a diary and her daughter edited it, threw parts out, and I think that says everything about where...
Well, you know, the old famous saying is children should be seen and not heard.
Mm.
That is Victorian. That's a Victorian saying, right?
The move to Australia, that happened at 17. And you say in the book, it's a wonderful line from your mom, where I guess a couple of you were thinking of going, right? Two of the brothers.
Two brothers already went.
Yeah, two had already
went. Job exchange.
Yeah, and then so the other two were thinking of going, and then your mom says, no, we'll all go. And so you all do go, right?
Mm. It was like that, in a way. The two eldest brothers went on a job thing, and they sent a letter back, you know. We love it down here, we're thinking of staying. I mean, my mother went into a tizzy, right?
Yeah.
She says, we're all sticking together, so we put our little call in to go there, right? But funny thing is, before all this happened, Canada, we wanted to come to Canada. and they said, you're too old. My dad was too old. We wanted to try New Zealand. Same again. Too old, blah, blah, blah. Australia said, come on down.
And they paid for the
trip. They paid for the whole trip, yeah. You see.
And it was a ship, right?
Yeah, 10 weeks on a beautiful ship.
Yeah. I'm thinking, so you were there at 17. How long did you stay there until
4.5 years.
Yeah, and then you came back to England, right?
Yeah, went back to England, yeah.
Yeah.
To see the Queen. I hadn't seen the Queen yet. Lived in London.
Yeah.
Notting Hill Gate.
Yeah.
You know, I was there for a good part of a year. Then I immigrated to Canada. You might say, in October the 9th, 1971, is when I arrived in Toronto.
Yeah. And the accent, people must ask you what the accent is, right?
Well, as soon as I get off the boat in Australia,
yeah.
See, it was like some non-sortable lamps, and I get that there wind above the ceiling came to rain, like, you know what I mean? Like, there's also the open seat, there's the gear, you know what I mean? And they say, come on, mate, speak the Queen's English, you know. Because, you know, they were speaking the Queen's English and I wasn't, you see. And I tell people, like, you know, I have the great misfortune of learning English in Liverpool, you know. And, you know, they stood me up one day, and our English teacher, stood me up in front of the class. I was about 13. And because I'd come from the downtown area of Liverpool to this outside area, there was hardly a kid in the class that had this twang, you see. So he'd pick on me all the time. He'd say, get up there and say, say this after me. The young girl had fair hair, you know. And I says, young Judy had fair hair, like, you know what I mean? It was the gear. And they'd all laugh, and all the kids would all laugh. And he'd say, how can you ever apply for a job in London with a, you know. And I says, I wouldn't want a sneaking job in London, you know what I mean? I'm going to sea.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a sailor, you know.
Yeah.
But we had our own twang, and in Liverpool, you have your own nicknames for everything. Like on the back cover is an alleyway, right? And we call them jiggers. So it'd be like, I was legging it from a Roger, run down a jigger, right? Or run around the Enog. I tripped over a dead jigger rabbit, like, you know, it was the gear, but it fell on the grotty deck. And it was fine because I found a tanner that was just enough for a 3-5 pack of woodies, you know. So a person from Liverpool would know all that, but the jigger rabbit is a stray cat that lives down the jigger, right?
Yeah.
A jigger rabbit, right?
Yeah.
Running, legging it from a Rosser. Well, a Rosser's pretty common in England. That's a policeman, right?
Yeah.
And it was the gear, but the gear is definitely Liverpool, which means great. It's the gear, mate.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, you had some relatives come and visit you, and they'd only lived in America for three, four years?
No, they'd been there 13 years.
13 years, yeah. And they'd lost.
In Mississippi.
they'd had a different...
These Liverpool people moved to Mississippi, and his name was Uncle Tom. But I tell you, he didn't have a cabin. There's Uncle Tom without a cabin in Mississippi. And he was a Pentecostal preacher, right?
Yeah. So yeah. How did he sound? Because I read it in the book. I sort of get the idea, but I'd like to hear
it. Yeah, well, you know, they go bang, bang, bang on the door. Yeah. We're all watching the telly, you know. Dad says, get up and answer the door. I look, open the door, this fellow in a big, loud-looking suit, you know. Big checkered suit, you know, that you typically see like...
An American.
a TV American evangelist, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
right? TV evangelist. His wife, they were this big bonnet on her head full of flowers, and I thought, my God, the circus just moved to town, you know what I mean? So he says, hi, is this where Albert Hayes lives? He's like, hi. I says, yeah, somebody asking for him, like. And he says, well, hallelujah, Jesus. And he started jumping up and down, glory be to God. And he's jumping up and down. I ran into the living room, like, Dad, there's a couple of nutcases at the front door there, like, and before I could turn around, he's already in the house.
Yeah.
It's Albert, Tommy. So this is his brother that surprised him on a visit. Didn't tell me he was coming, right? And they'd only been in Mississippi 13 years, and I said, there wasn't one Scouse word coming out of their mouths, eh? Scouse, like, it's Liverpool.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at him, like, you know, and they're sort of, like, very flamboyant and, you know, like, in your face and all that. Bit of craziness going on here, but my dad was going right along with it, and I saw a new side of my dad altogether.
Yeah.
And he said something like, well, praise the Lord. I thought, what? You just said that? God, I couldn't believe it, you know.
So you must have...
I got rallies down there, man.
Yeah, you must have a book. Well, I mean, there's stuff in here that you couldn't fit in here. I mean, you must have another book just for the first 17 years, right?
Yeah, well, I could go on and on, you know. I mean, I could have added all kind of silliness to all that, you know. But I think that's just a good a good highlight of of that time, you know. And what I wanted to do too is paint the picture of the world I was living in, and you know, the prevalence of trouble and poverty, because it was poverty all over, and we're all in patched up clothes. Like, we learned from a very early age how to patch and mend our own clothes.
Mm-hmm.
I used to mend the shoes in the house, stick it on the old last, put a new heel on, and all that. I was a little boy.
Yeah.
So that book represents that moment. And then I think, like, you know, enough's enough. 17, I'm in the land of Oz. I call it the land of Oz, you know. I follow the yellow brick road and end in the land of Oz. And there I am now, baptized into this new, brand new, hot, sunny beach full of bikini, you know, like the whole world was like paradise.
Yeah.
Like Diana going to paradise, right? Fruit on every front yard, you know, pick a peach and a banana on the way to work, you know. So, like, it was all there wide open. I thought, the world I just came from, they haven't got a clue of where I just came from.
Yeah.
The poverty.
Have you ever been back to Liverpool?
Last time was 2002.
Yeah. And so, as you said, you don't know anyone else there anymore, right?
No. And there's a lot of I wouldn't want to even think about meeting again.
Yeah.
You know, that's why, in a way, you know, I don't go on Facebook. You know, Facebook, there's another word for Facebook, right?
Yeah.
So, you go in there and, you know, next thing you know, you'll dig up all kind of history that you don't want to talk about, or people. So, Liverpool was completely changed when I went down there. My whole district of Everton wasn't even like when I left. It was all changed again. They changed it like two or three times.
Yeah.
And the old hill, the Everton Brow, where I grew up, was the highest part of Liverpool town, you know, which overlooks the River Mersey, you know, with the ferry crosses the Mersey and all that. That's all gone. There's a big park. My old streets are all dead and gone. The names have all been gone and changed. And then even in Chilwell, when I went to Chilwell to check it out in 2002, all my area was flattened again and new ghettos were being built. It was a ghetto, eh?
Mm.
Wall-to-wall ghettos, like filing cabinets for human beings, right?
Yeah.
And so they move all the trouble out there, and they move it vertically instead of sideways.
Yeah. That's what you say in the book, that judges beget judges, and working class people, you know, have working class... There's no upward mobility in that society. Maybe there is in the... Well, I guess there is in Canada, but, I mean, it's still, you know, it's not as pronounced as it is there.
Well, I in my school, I didn't know one person... They had a professional type of family background, you know, whose dad was a doctor or a lawyer or a dentist or this, that, and the other, right? They were all like working class people. They were carpenters and brickies and labourers, working at the factories or the docks, or the absentee sailors, you know, out at sea. But, they do, you know, they do beget that kind of thing. It's sort of like a historical, and, you know, Britain's like that anyway, right?
Yeah.
The class distinction thing.
Yeah, they marry the same people and the same, you know.
Well, it's also your voice, you know. Like the old scripture says, like St. Peter, they said, on the night that Jesus was betrayed, they said to St. Peter, "You're a Galilean, aren't you?" He says, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, thy speech betrayeth thee." So, you know what? You can't get rid of your speech.
Yeah.
You're stuck with a certain accent, you got it, mate.
Your accent is your fate. That's the title in the chapter.
Your accent
in the book.
Is your fate.
Yeah. So you have continued writing, and one day we'll get to read what happens to you after 17?
Yeah. And what I'm doing now is I'm doing a different type of mode and also a different type of exercise, which is when stories spring to mind, even if they're in Canada, I write them.
Mm.
But then that'll retrace me back to something earlier. So instead of just letting that go and saying, I'll write that at the end sometime, I'll write out the stories that come now. Because I haven't got to write that again later. And that also jogs the memory of something earlier. And I have a title for the book already.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if I say on this, what do they call it?
Plagiarized?
No, there's a little C in the middle of a circle.
Oh, copyrighted.
That's right.
Yeah.
So I got the copyright on this title, which is called Double Immigrant, which means I've immigrated once to Australia and once to Canada, right? Yeah. And there are a few people around I've met that have been double immigrants, you know. But, you know, to be an immigrant, I tell you, like, I got a lot of empathy and feeling towards a lot of new arrivals that come into the country.
Yeah.
You know, and I say, God bless him, mate. You know, like people who are running away from war-torn countries, let's give them all the support we can.
Yeah.
Yet they're not running away because they want to. They have to.
Yeah, and the other thing that we don't think about is, I mean, yes, it is heaven, paradise for them to come here because they're not in a war-torn area anymore, but that doesn't mean it's over. That there is another struggle of trying to get involved in society and participating in and you know, feel at home.
Well,
if this is home, you know,
like the first chapter of my new book, which will be out sometime, demonstrates arriving in a new country with a different type of speech,
yeah,
a different accent, a dialect, you know, and they're all like ridiculing you. So you know, that's what I don't like that. I don't like being around people who think that just because they were born here, they can ridicule someone else from any part in the world that arrives here.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Canada is a melting pot. We all come here, and a lot of the people you see of Asian background or whatever, they were born and bred here, and so were their parents.
Yeah.
You know, so that racist bullshit is garbage, you know. Yeah. So we've got to get rid of that and you know, open our hearts and our doors to people who just want to start a new life, for goodness sake, you know.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that?
Have your brothers read the book?
Yeah.
What did they think?
Critical.
Really?
Yeah. Me and my brothers, you know, for certain things we were close.
Yeah.
But there's an awful lot of distance. So I went through an awful lot of experiences on my own. And actually, not even with close friends, but actually on my own. I learned to, adapt to loneliness. I learned to also accept the shunning of things, or you know, even ridicule. You mentioned earlier the things I'd like to go back and redo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a couple of guys I'd love to give a good black eye to right now, I tell you, because they were ridiculing, they were bullying and all that, and they were older than me and bigger than me, you know, and all that. It'd be nice to meet them again, like, and just sort of like give them a word,
yeah,
have a nice little chat, you know.
Yeah. Well, you can find them on that website, or that.
No, I'm not going to. Probably inside somewhere, you know.
Yeah. Well, when you write a memoir like this, and as I said off the top, it's a beautiful book. What do you think about in terms of looking back at your life? I mean, do you understand life a little bit better because you have written a book like this?
The next book will explain how I got through that first book.
Mm.
The next book takes me into a religious time where I turn away, like my dad did at the age of 30, from drinking, gambling, womanizing, ding-a-ding-a-ding, and I went head first into religion. And I became a lay preacher, right, for 4 years or so. And during those 4 years, I gave all my money away every week, my wages, to two places. One was an orphanage in South Korea, an orphanage. And the other one was what I put towards a crisis centre that I started in downtown Sydney, Australia, for runaway kids. And I pride myself in one thing today, is that in 69, I put together a 15-year-old hooker who ran off the street, and we saved her and got her rescued and gave her a job and found her a place and a new career and a life. And also a drug addict who was 19 years old. And those two married.
Huh.
And today they're presently grandparents. And they were put together from my crisis centre in downtown George Street, Sydney, Australia. So there's one thing I can pride myself in, that I put money towards what? Mending some lives. That means a lot to me.
One of the reasons why I didn't finish the book as quickly as I could have was because I didn't want it to end. And I mean, I can't wait to read whatever you've got next, because man, it's someone used the line that you're a Renaissance man. I mean, that
the missus.
Yeah, I mean that doesn't even explain, you know, half your life almost.
No, well, I can, I can make things, I can really break things very well.
Yeah,
I love demolition jobs. You know, but I like music. I like inventing songs. Me and the kids, when they were little, would sit in this great big clawfoot bathtub that we have, right? They'd be that end and I'd be this end, right? I made all these little boats like the Spanish Armada taking on the English, right? And we'd be playing all these games in the bathtub. They're two little tiny kids, right? Then they'd say, Dad, let's tells a story about so-and-so, right? So we all made up stories. And my kids got into that, creating and making up stories and songs on the spot.
Yeah.
So making up songs on the spot. You know, you don't have to be drunk to do that. Which I was close to last night. We went out in this big celebration last night. We launched the book last night.
Yeah.
It was fabulous.
Uh-huh.
And my kids did say to me, "Dad, you know what I mean? We're driving."
But it has been a good life. I mean, there have been some difficulties, but I mean, when you look back at it all, where you are today, I mean, it's been a hell of a rewarding life, hasn't it?
Marvelous life. Yeah, I've had a very adventurous life. Even at an early age, that was very adventurous, you know.
Yeah.
And other things I followed, you know, my travels, like up in the Yukon for a year.
Yeah.
You know, and in Australia, like, you know, lived for a little while with the Aboriginal family in the outback, you know. Hunting kangaroos and eating snakes, you know,
wow.
That kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Then up in the Yukon where I shot my caribou, you know, with my native friend, my native Indian friend up there, Charlie Arry. That was in October of 72. See, a lot of these things did happen in the early part of my life, you know.
Yeah.
Then when you get married, all life ends, right?
Yeah. But you, it all began anew for you, didn't it?
No, life never ends and the adventures never end.
Yeah.
So, you know. This next book is a lot more difficult to write than this one. Because if you talk about the confession box the last time,
yeah,
this is like putting your head on the guillotine block.
I met you once when I saw Mona at a book thing.
Oh.
And I've really enjoyed getting to know you through this book.
Oh, yeah.
And I so appreciate you coming in to do this. I wanted to do this in person because the book meant more to me than you'll ever know.
So, can I ask you a question?
Yeah, you may.
If you were a Liverpool lad, born in that time there, would you be a good mate of mine?
I'd be scared of you, probably.
No, you wouldn't. You'd be a good mate of mine.
Would I?
Yes.
I'd like to think so, because, I mean...
Because I always surrounded myself with smart, lovable, laughable people who take a good joke, crack a good joke, don't mind a little bit of the other side of life.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's so fun that I would...
Yeah, you'd be a mate of mine.
I'd enjoy that, yeah.
Probably belong to the same chess club.
Well, I don't play chess, so...
Well, I was chess champion in Liverpool when I was 11 years old.
Wow.
For my age group, anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I used to love to play chess, you know. So, I like good intellectual conversation, good-hearted people, and I can't stand snobs.
Well, it's been so fun to meet you again. So thanks for this, Peter.
Lovely. We ran out of time.
We'll talk again soon, I'm sure. MotherTonguePublishing.com is where you can get the book. That's where I got it. Order it there. Liverpool Lad, Adventures Growing Up in Post-War Liverpool is published by Mother Tongue. It's author Peter Huss. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantin.